This is Faith and Fitness Magazine, and this is Brad Bloom, the publisher. I am so excited to be able to share with you a conversation today that I'm having with Katie Spotts. Katie is an endurance athlete who raises awareness and support for the global water crisis. To date, she has raised over $400,000 for more than 10,000 people to have water. She's a former YMCA personal trainer, and she's a member of the Coast Guard. She attends East Point Church in the Portland, Maine area. Katie, thanks for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you are currently training for a big run. How many miles is that going to be?
It will be the longest run I've ever done, 130 miles across the entire state of Maine.
But you're doing that in little pieces, right?
No, it's actually all in one go. So to date, I've done a few 100-mile races, and the quickest 100 that I've done is in 19 hours. But because it is kind of hilly here in Maine, I'm thinking it will take about 24 to 30 hours of running nonstop.
Oh, wow. Well, watch out for the moose. Tell me now, let's back up a little bit in time, and I guess you're most known for a transatlantic trip that you took. Go ahead and share about that.
Sure. So at the time, I was 19 years old, and I was living in Australia, and just by, you know, God puts different people in our paths right when we need it. And I found out about ocean rowing from a stranger on a bus. We were just talking about endurance challenges. And once I found out about the idea, it could never let me go. So at 22, I set off from West Africa in Dakar, Senegal, and I rowed a 19-foot rowboat all the way to South America. So it was 3,000 miles, 10,000 oar strokes a day, or about a million to cross. And it really wasn't the goal, but I found out that there hadn't been someone that was as young as I was. So it was a world record. So it was the youngest person to row solo across the Atlantic. No follow boat, no helicopter. Just me and the dolphins and God.
Wow, congratulations on that. I've got to ask you, because being a father and a grandparent, I've got to ask what is an obvious question to me, and that is, how on earth would your parents just go, sure, go for it?
So I was a sponge at that age, and I was very eager to do new adventures, and my parents thought it was like a phase I was going through, and that they didn't worry about it too much because they thought, well, we'll just ride it out. Eventually she'll, you know, be on to something else. And they definitely freaked out once I got the boat, and they realized that there was nothing they could do to stop me. But it was hard. It was definitely a lot of challenge, for maybe even more challenging for them, just because they were sitting at home worrying about me and I was, you know, focusing on that one oar stroke. So their protective instincts were strong, and they definitely did not want me to, you know, do that and face that challenge alone.
As you reflect back on that, I've got to also ask the question, you're telling me that there was no other person alongside you.
Correct. Yep. There wasn't a follow boat. There wasn't a helicopter.
So what safety net was there? Let's say, you know, whatever. And you're like, I'm going to die if I don't do something. Then what?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Like when I said goodbye to my family at the airport, we were looking at each other with tears in our eyes thinking, wow, this could be the last time, you know. So death was definitely something that we all knew could be a real possibility. But having said that, I was really diligent about, making sure I had equipment like an emergency beacon so I can let off an SOS to get help. But it really just depends. If it could be a couple hours or it could be over a day, depending on where I was, depending on what other boats were around. So it was a huge unknown. But yeah, the emergency beacon was the biggest piece of equipment. And I did have a tracker so people could see where I was. And I guess my mom was clicking refresh just to like have that reassurance that I was actually moving. And so it was definitely a huge unknown, but
so people were ready to jump and rescue if all of a sudden they saw something was going amiss.
It is a requirement, like to have certain pieces of equipment for safety out there. But yeah, it depending on what part of the ocean, where, what Coast Guard covers what area, and if could have been a day. Yeah.
Wow. And I'm curious, one other thing, because I do kayaking here in my area, and on a windy day, you know, if you're not really rowing hard, the wind will blow you where it wants you to go.
Absolutely.
So like, how did you manage that? It seems to me that you would expend a lot of extra energy and maybe go way off course sometimes.
I did get blown back towards Africa at certain points. But I had an underwater parachute, a para-anchor, which minimized that drift. But because I worked with a weather guy, for the most part, I was being helped towards my destination. But, I didn't really worry too much about landing until, you know, the last week or so, because it was just so far away and the weather can change in a minute that being precise wasn't as important as just getting west. And as long as you keep going west, eventually you will hit land.
Yeah, interesting. So did you use some sort of a GPS or something so you can at least sort of get an idea of where you're headed?
I did, but even that is a little bit overrated in my, like, as long as you look in the sky, you can tell what's east and west by sunrise and sunset. So even if I didn't, I don't know, I just feel like, it you can make it very high tech, but at the end of the day, if you have fuel and if you have your oars, that's and your desalinator, that's really all you need.
All right. So you're out there in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. We're going to get beyond the Atlantic story here in just a minute, but you're just singing, like, you know, all kinds of Christian praise songs and reading scriptures, and this is like just the most ultimate, you know, that anybody could imagine in terms of fellowship alone with God. Is that how that worked?
That is actually, couldn't be more true. I didn't know who God was. It took me years after the row for me to really surrender and for me to become a believer. So I was out there alone, thinking I was alone, but I felt, there were definitely moments looking back where I was like, oh, I see how God was working there and God was working at that moment. And looking back, I could definitely see, like, the fourth way mark, I was really feeling pretty deflated and I wanted some kind of sign of hope or something to kind of cheer me on to reach that milestone. And I wasn't sure what I could do. Usually it's like, eat another Snickers bar or, you know, listen to a comedian to kind of pick me up, and nothing was really exciting me, but I had a pod of dolphins around me, and they were like doing flips and they were just surrounding my boat, and it was just at the moment that I was reaching the fourth way mark. And looking back, I'm like, that was so God, that was so one of those divine intervention moments. And yeah, it definitely makes sense now, but at the time I wasn't a believer, and so my God was achievement and doing good works. But it wasn't until about 3 years after the row that a friend kind of introduced me and started me on a new path.
Your history prior to going on that new path when you didn't know God, was that because maybe your family or your friends you did know of God and you just chose not to. In other words, what I'm trying to get here is I'd like for the listeners to get a little better idea of the person who doesn't know God. Are they this really bad, hedonistic, godless person, or you know, what's it like to not know God? I'm not being facetious here, but I'm just sort of curious. As you look at your life now, what was life like prior?
So, like, it's kind of like I do the same things. I'm still running, but the engine, what it's running on, is just so much different. So, life without God, it feels like you're clinging on to what the world says is right and good, which is always wavering, which is always shifting. And for me, it kind of took getting that worldly success or high off of these endurance challenges. So I was doing a lot of motivational speaking, and I was, you know, spreading this message of hope, but yet I felt
a lot of good stuff.
Yes, but at the same time, I did feel lost. I think a life without God is just, it's very confusing and disorienting, and it's almost like a constant struggle to prove your worth. Like, I think that's a very a very central theme into what life looks like without God, that you're constantly striving to achieve something, to make something of yourself, to prove lovability, to prove, prove your worth. But when your worth isn't defined by the world, it's just a sense of peace and relief that you're a child of God. And it really comes down to love and knowing that you are loved instead of having to feel like you're constantly working towards that.
So what was the point where Christ became your all? Describe a little bit of that, how that all led up and then the transition.
Yeah, so it was just at a history museum, and my friend Megan and I were, you know, kind of stumbling around, like just checking out all the different exhibits, and we ran across the Lucy fossil, and we're just kind of, what do you think? And I could sense
this is the evolution display.
Yeah, exactly. And so I could sense a little bit of hesitation, but once she did open up about her faith, it was just cascading out of her, and I knew she was hesitant because she didn't want to, you know, come out too strong, or I think I could definitely sense the hesitation, but it definitely intrigued me because I was raised Catholic, and it was more, rules-based, and that never really resonated with me. And for her, she was sharing that it's relational, and I just left that conversation with a million more questions, and it was similar to the way I felt about ocean rowing. Like, wait, I'm so curious. Just this curiosity was awakened in me. And that's when I found myself going to church and finding those answers and watching those sermons. And then, it was definitely, a gradual process, but I started seeing and feeling things that I never did before, and I started to understand, and God started working in my life, and I feel transformed from what I was to who I am now. And maybe on paper, maybe it doesn't even make sense, but behind the scenes, it's just knowing that that's the foundation from which you move from as being second, as being servant, as being obedient, rather than just kind of humbling ourselves and knowing that we're part of His story, of
yep.
God's plan, and instead of anything else.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I'm speaking today with Katie Spotts here on Faith and Fitness Magazine. She is an endurance athlete that raises awareness and support for global water crisis, and she's been sharing about some of her life and how she discovered Christ and how she became an endurance athlete. I want to continue on, Katie, and ask you, now that you are living this faith-filled life, how endurance athletics has changed for you?
So when I didn't know God, I knew how detrimental endurance was for me, because that was my God. I was only as good as miles I could run. I was only as good as people I could help. Like, I measured my worth and attached so much to it that it no longer became enjoyable, and it was never enough. Like, that constant never enough. That was the enemy trying to use some gift that God gave me and use it against me. So I found myself at a place where I just wanted to throw it all away. And I did. So I made a goal one year to not do any endurance challenges. I was just so burnt out on, like, constantly pushing my body to go further and faster. And I think it was actually that year that I did have that conversation. And now I see what endurance feels like. And to me, endurance now is a way to glorify God. So every run is done with gratitude. Every mile that I can run is a gift from God. And yeah, and I'm more interested in, hey, God, I think the last, like, organized marathon, I wasn't wearing the watch, and I was just going off of feel, and there was no, like, I have to do this time, and it was actually my fastest marathon, because it was more about running with God and surrendering it and just saying, you know, show me what you can do through me. And so I thought at one point that because I worshiped fitness over God and fitness was my God, I thought the answer was, well, get rid of it. But now I just see it as fitness can be a way to talk to God, to be with God, to thank God, and God's ready to go on some runs too. But
there you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Tell me, Katie, give the readers, the listeners here, just a little bit of insight as to, on the physical side of things, what are some of the qualities of strength training, you know, becoming stronger to be able to do endurance activities?
So my training right now is very similar to a lot of marathon training plans, in that every week you're usually going 10% further. If you go any further than that 10%, you're risking injury. And then every 3 weeks, there's a week of recovery, which is a 30% decrease. So, like, last weekend, my longest run was 45 miles. This weekend's run is 49, and then 54, and then I'll have a recovery week. So, and then I do my one long run on the weekends. I do a shakeout run midweek, just so it kind of moves things along. And then I'm doing every day, except Sunday, I do some kind of strength, anywhere between 20 or 40 minutes of, like, mainly body weight exercises. And my main focus is injury prevention and building endurance. So a lot of the strength is focused on, like, hips. A lot of people, hips and knees, like doing different stabilizers, doing things like bar. That's kind of my go-to right now, just bar classes, which is really just using your own body weight and core.
And do you have team members that give you input on that physical training and becoming stronger?
I want to say that, like, right now I'm actually doing like a Bible study for runners, and that's my team I got right now. We read scripture and we look, and, you know, last week was all about motivation and goal setting and what the Bible says about that. And this week is about breath and breathing. And so
if you get an injury or, you know, to actually do those mathematical calculations on what percentage to increase, is that all pretty much just you sort of figuring that out?
Well, I have worked with coaches in the past, and then I am like certified like a personal trainer. And so I think a part of that is just having done this and reading other people. Like some of my endurance buddies, you know, will say it's crazy that I only run 2 days a week right now, but I'm not burnt out. I don't feel any like niggling injuries, and I'm fresh. Like I want to do my long runs, and I don't feel burnt out by it. So I think it's just a bit of trial and error, like over the years of what works for you. But if I was running a marathon, I'd be running 5 days a week. But because, you know, almost running two marathons this Saturday, it does take at least 3 days to really, you know, think about moving the body and pushing it in any way. So I'm more concerned about recovering than I am about it. Recovering.
That's really good to hear, because I think a lot of people discount the recovery portion. They think that, you know, well, I need to get back to it. And in fact, what they need to do is rest even more.
Well, that's exactly it, because, I mean, you don't get stronger when you're exercising. You get stronger when you recover, when you rebuild those muscles that were broken down. So if I'm questioning, you know, whether to push or whether to, you know, take it easy. And there's other ways to aid and assist recovery. Like it's active recovery, just going on a walk, just taking an easy bike ride, or, going for a swim. Those are great, you know, ways to, if you're really feeling like you want to do something and can't rest, at least you could take it easy and use those as ways to, you know, promote recovery, because recovery doesn't always mean just sitting there. It means moving, and easy movement and foam rolling and stretching and all that.
So we're talking a lot about our theme, which is certified strong. And in it, we're, you know, as we often do in Faith and Fitness Magazine, talking not only about physical but spiritual. And a lot of times people would think, well, that spiritual strength, that's a nice thing. It's you know, it's altruistic, good ideas, and it even has sort of a subtle impact on the physical training. But it's not really something that directly correlates with the physical strength or that plays out in the full picture. I'd love for you to take just a moment and share how you've indeed found that the spiritual strength may in fact even be more critical in terms of that overall performance and truly being strong.
It's just like funny as you're saying that, in my mind it's like, you know, God's better than Gatorade. Like God, if your fuel is God. And I think I don't know, maybe because I've only been Christian for like 3 years now, so I'm like toddler, and like this is all very like new feelings and new ways. But the track in your head could be not enough, and with God, that's not God. That God never plays that track that you're not enough. God, if you're doing it in a God-honoring way, for me it just feels like joyful and like a celebration, like of what gift of that God gave us with our bodies and moving our bodies. And it can be an act of celebration. And like, I don't know, a lot like responses to what I do to my body is not meant for look at what I can do, but it's look at how cool God made our bodies to be vessels of endurance. And it's much more joyful. And as an endurance athlete, it all comes down to that mental component. Like, there's people that are, you know, faster than me, and probably, you know, if they had that desire, they could definitely, you know, do these things. But I think that's more sustaining than anything else, just running on joy.
We talk a lot about being others-minded, doing fitness for a deeper purpose.
Mm.
That seems to, as I look at your story, to have become your obsession. It's not just a nice thing that you do occasionally. This is your whole focus now, is to be others-minded with your fitness. Share about the cause that you support and just how that really plays out in making a difference in your experience of your fitness.
So I found out about the water crisis maybe a decade ago, and it just hit me at the core, you know, like, how could we have so much? And at the time it was 1 in 6 people without clean water. And I was just thinking back, like, I've never met one of these 1 in 6 people. And I just felt like, you know, a little bit angry, like, what do you mean they don't have clean water? What do you mean they can't go to school? What do you mean they don't give their children's names until they're 5 because they don't know if they'll survive? Because it's mainly babies and infants that, you know, can't handle the germs that are in the dirty water. And so I just knew I wanted to do something. And that's when I started to see how endurance and whatever you do could be a vessel and channel for helping others. And I just felt like God was pushing me to really explore more, and gave me that desire to help. And so I have been able to kind of pair the passion for endurance and for helping with the water crisis. I've been able to see some of the projects in India, South Africa, and Kenya.
Cool. And the water program that you work with, is it purely just a humanitarian, or is there a faith component to it?
Oh, yeah. So for the Run for Water, it's for this organization called Life Water International, and they are a faith-based Christian organization. So they are meeting the physical need as well as the spiritual needs of where they work. So they work in Uganda, Ethiopia, and Tanzania. And so the funds raised for the run are going to a community in Tanzania so they could get clean water.
Nice. And so in addition to actually getting water, there's people that are doing some sort of ministry alongside those people as well.
Exactly. So they work through their local churches, and that's central to you know, what they do is letting them know who God is and that they're loved.
Well, we're getting close on time here. So, Katie, I want to just ask you, you've got this run through the entire state of Maine. What prompted you to do that? And what do you anticipate will be your experience as you're doing over 24 hours worth of running through the state of Maine?
I love being able to make endurance not just, you know, testing the body, but being able to explore. And I just moved to Maine here in November, so I'm just really excited to see and explore nature along the way and attempt to run further than I ever have been before, and help out. The ultimate goal is to raise $20,000 for Life Water. The original goal was 10,000, but we surpassed that. So I thought, you know, there's a lot of people that could use some more, so why not? So it's raised to 20,000.
Well, Katie, it's been great talking with you. Any closing thoughts that you want to share? Anything that maybe I didn't ask that you feel would be important for people to consider?
So if they would like to support the cause or to follow with the run, the website is just katiespots.com.
Awesome. Well, I've been speaking today with Katie Spots. She is an endurance athlete, and she's got a run in September of 2020 across the state of Maine to raise funds and awareness for the global water crisis. And as she mentioned, you can look at Katie Spots, that's SPOTZ.com, to get more information. We'll have the link to that in this feature. Katie, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
See you on that next run. Take care.
All right. Yeah, bye.